Hi, everybody. It's Jim and Tricia, and this is the fifth of our lectures on deep change or slow death and the importance of culture in congregational change. And we just welcome you back to this ongoing conversation. And in our conversation today, we're going to deal with space, the fifth part of congregational culture. But before we get to that, we want to just remind you of the basic assumptions that this course is built on. It's our job to make these assumptions clear, and it's your job to test these assumptions in your own life. So here they are.
Yeah, so it's good to be back with you. And as Tricia said, here they are. The first assumption is that North America has become a mission field, and strategy for reaching a mission field is different than strategy for living in a church culture. The second assumption is that culture eats strategy for breakfast. The third is that mostly we have cultures that developed in a church context. The fourth assumption is that pastoral leaders must understand what culture is and how it develops so that they can develop culture in their specific context. And the fifth one is that we are working on five key components of congregational culture in this course, with a goal of each part being strong and functional and all the parts interacting in a way that produces a missional culture.
So building on all of that, as well as the four key components that we've done up until now, today we're talking about this fifth piece of the culture, which we're calling space. And for our purposes today, we're referring to the physical space within which the congregation exists, and then also the neighborhood context that the church belongs in. And so let's dig in and see what we've got here. Let's start out just by talking about the building, the physical space, and what that has to say about culture. I want you to just take a minute and think about how often you associate culture with a particular physical space. If I picked you up and dropped you into an Apple store, but there were no logos anywhere, and even if there were no products anywhere, you would know immediately that you were in an Apple store. And the way that space is designed is very pointedly intended to communicate a certain culture about what it means to be an Apple user and who you are because you use Apple products. Very carefully curated space to give you those kinds of messages.
And there was likely a time when churches did that. It's the reason that churches look so much alike if they have any age to them. I'm not sure we're paying that kind of attention today in a way that that we once did. As we talk about the building, there's so many variables that that come into the conversation. How old is your building? How much institutional strength is there to maintain and upgrade the facilities? I'll never forget the very first conversation that I had with a leadership team when I first went to work at Union Baptist Association when I was about 35 years old. Was a leadership team of seven people in a facility that would seat about 200, and they were meeting in the pastor's office on a Sunday morning. What they wanted to do is deed the property to us, but they didn't want that legal transaction to take place until the pastor died or until all their members were gone. And I mean, there are a lot of things about that that are both tragic and funny, but the thing that was, one of the things that was so compelling to me was the building was falling down around them. Mm-hmm. They had just declined to a place where they didn't have any resources to take care of anything. And so the roof had a hole in it and the air conditioning needed to be replaced. And so that's a factor. How young or old are the members, and how much available income do they have to work on the building? There's just so many variables when you're talking about a building. And so as we have this conversation today, hear it as kind of broad strokes that you're going to have to figure out how to apply in your particular context.
Well, and the thing is, right, none of us got any of this in seminary, right? I mean, we didn't have courses in you know, how to manage a building or how to do real estate for, you know, church life or any of that. And so all of that, I think, has just always been challenging. And then in 2020, like all our assumptions about buildings were exposed and tested. How many conversations have I seen on social media about who is the church apart from the building? If we're not gathering in our building, who are we? And I've heard several churches, pastors in traditional churches with traditional buildings, talk just recently about how this year, 2021, is going to be the year where their task is to reconnect people to each other and then reconnect people to the building. And just recently, I was in a conversation with two different pastors in two very different churches. And in one church, you know, this would probably be one end of the continuum, they were saying, because of COVID, we now have a congregation that is 40% not local.
Wow.
And we have to figure out how to be a congregation that is, you know, a one unified congregation, but only about 60% of us live within driving distance of the church. And that same week, I had a meeting with another pastor, an associate, who was saying that the senior pastor in their church had told them not to distribute Advent bags or worship aids to families this year, because that would discourage them from coming to the building. He wanted everyone, you know, at the building. And if they were getting spiritual resources from the church outside of the building, maybe they wouldn't come. And that would maybe be on the other end. But 2020 has surfaced everything we didn't know we believed about our buildings.
Exactly, exactly. Well, and so that reminds me in a roundabout kind of way, about several years ago, I was in a conversation with a regional denominational exec from the state of New York. And I asked her, I said, if you had a magic wand, you know, the great coaching question, if you had a magic wand and could get all of your congregations to do just one thing, what would that be? She didn't bat an eye. She said, oh, I know exactly what I would do. I would have all of them sell their buildings and use the proceeds to redesign their ministry. And when I asked her why, she said, because all of our buildings are old and deteriorating. Not only do we spend way too much of our available resources on upkeep, but the buildings define what's possible in our ministry, and they limit our imagination in some big ways. I got to tell you, I've thought about that conversation for a long time. And as we've already said, her thinking is not a rule or even a guideline for all congregations. It simply illustrates, as do the two stories that Tricia just told, how powerful the building is in shaping our thinking of and our possibilities for ministry.
And so many churches are in that situation where they have an existing building that, approach ministry without even questioning what to do with this building that we've got. But there are also a lot of other situations. So churches who meet in storefronts, and their pastors regularly say, you know, people say this isn't real church because we meet in a storefront, or, you know, feel disrespected for that. Churches meet in schools and theaters, and, you know, that has a lot of advantages, especially for churches that are just starting out. But they talk about how that, you know, they burn their people out constantly setting up and tearing down, and how hard it is to do youth and children, you know, in that those spaces, and, you know, having no place for offices or a place to do meetings not on Sundays. And at the same time, there are some churches that meet in buildings that are really well designed for the kind of ministry that the church is called to do in the community. And so that means in this conversation, we are not even close to saying that there's one solution for everyone. But we are saying that if we want to see culture change, we are going to have to think about the mental models and the assumptions that underlie the decisions we make about our space.
Yeah, I would almost like to just pause there or ask the listeners to turn the recording off and just do some deep thinking and reflection on that very thing about the mental models and assumptions that we hold about our space. To have this conversation today, first, what we want to do is think about the building and the various ways that it can be used. I think one of the biggest challenges congregations face is that when they come to this conversation, they almost can't get to what could we do or what's possible or what could we imagine, because they immediately go to the question of funding. You know, funding for repairs. Is there funding for upgrades or other adjustments to the building that would allow ministry to happen in a more effective way? And so we want to start today by talking about funding as a way of having a conversation about the building, or maybe a way of empowering a conversation about the building. My thinking in particular has been influenced by a book that I recommend. The title of it is From The Coming Revolution in Church Economics, Why Tithes and Offerings Are No Longer Enough and What to Do About It. The book's by a couple of pastors named Mark DeMaze, I'm not sure how I'm pronouncing that name, DeYMaz, and Harry Lee. And the title of the book suggests its contents. Mark's a pastor in, Mark and Harry are pastors in Arkansas, who have effectively led a congregation through a significant transition in how they use their building, how they fund their work. And in the book, what they suggest is what the title conveys. In summary, they say that the coming revolution is going to be driven by the fact that tithes and offerings can no longer be counted on to fund all of the ministry of the church. He also suggests that what appears to be a movement toward taxing churches will only exacerbate this challenge. And he does a really great historical overview of how American culture has changed. It goes all the way back to the 40s and 50s, where, you know, many women were stay-at-home moms. There were one income households, and how that's changed over time, and how the cost of living has gone up. And he just historically does a really great job of painting a picture of how we got to this place. And then he makes the assertion that for most American households today, it takes two incomes to be able to survive and thrive in the context that we live in. And so in that kind of historical context, then what he does is he proposes that going forward, churches are going to need to think about actually doing their work in three different ways. And what he does is he names he would almost draw a Venn diagram where he says each one of these is independent and autonomous, and yet they are part of one whole and they're overlapping work. So let me just see if I can quickly summarize the three teams that he talks about. The first one that he talks about is the spiritual team that does the traditional work of worship, evangelism, disciple making, church planting, all the things that we would think of that a church does, and all the things that we would think of that people give tithes and offerings to be able to help them do. The second one could be included in the first one, and many churches it is, but he's suggesting that it be developed as a second team. He calls it the social team, and what they do is they advance the work of compassion and justice ministry in the community. They're nonprofit, and so that means that they're able to do the work of addressing the needs of the community, and they can partner with groups. They can draw resources from grants, from the government, from other organizations that fund that kind of work. They can do all kinds of partnerships in a way that particularly a denominational or even a non-denominational church is not able to do. And so he would say these two nonprofit groups, the spiritual team, the social team, and then he would say the third team is the financial team. And the financial team exists to encourage and develop small businesses and generate sustainable income. And this third team is actually a for-profit business. Two stories that I know. One is the church in Chicago that I'm working with, where a pretty healthy congregation of 400 or 500 people has begun to, they're engaged in the deep change or slow death congregation conversation. And one of the things that they're doing is that they are converting some of their space into a kind of social ministry or justice ministry mall. And so there is a counseling center that's there. They're working on getting a woman's shelter that's in the community to use space there. All of those groups that are going to come are going to pay rent to the congregation, and it's a way of reconfiguring and rethinking their space. And the rent that they pay would be resources that would help them to actually build out the space in different kind of ways. And so that's one story at a really high level that I know. A story that I know much more personally. I have a brother who pastors a church in outside of Atlanta. And when he went there to pastor that church, one of the things that they did was, before they even planted the church, they started a resale shop. And the resale shop employed people from the community. It got them in touch with people in the business sector. The community leaders liked them because they were paying taxes, contributing to the economic base. And in about two and a half years, they were doing $1 million worth of business that then launched a second business when people donated furniture that wasn't usable, they did this second business where they put the unusable furniture in a different place. And some homeless people that they'd gotten connected to who had some skills would rebuild the furniture, and that became a part of their deal. And again, what we're not doing is saying, so you ought to go do that. What we're saying is that that in this book, that the Coming Revolution in Church Economics, that it just provides a different way of thinking about, you know, if the tithes and offerings are not able to do everything that we need to do, how can we reconfigure our way of thinking about money that then empowers us to have resources that would trigger our imagination and open us up to different kinds of possibilities that we might not ever think about if we didn't have the resources to do things with.
You and I have a friend in Europe that I think has been working on this for 10 or 15 years, mm-hmm. just yeah. the idea of micro businesses and social enterprise and mm-hmm. a way of living missionally through business and through nonprofit engagement that, I don't know, maybe she works with both a European context mm-hmm. and here in the United States. And definitely the mental models that we have in the United States are a little different, maybe because our churches still do have people in them.
Right.
You know, we're still a little behind Europe in terms of changing culture where church buildings are concerned. Mm-hmm. But that's one of the ways that they have started to address that. It seems to me that what leadership is going to be in this conversation is to be able to hold all of these streams at one time, right? And to right. keep them focused on a common vision, pursuing a common mission, in community with each other. You know, I can imagine how leadership is going to have to learn to deal with, you know, instilling a sense of abundance. If we work together, we can do all these things, rather than a sense of scarcity. Mm-hmm. So who's going to get the resources of the church? And, I think that the role of the leader in doing what you described, or even doing something different, is going to be so important here.
Part of what I love about the book that we just referenced is that they tell some of those stories. They say exactly what you just said, that apart from a common vision, pursued three different ways, but all toward a common vision, that this creates more chaos than it does help. And they told some real stories about working through conflict and figuring out how to make this work. They don't pretend that this is an easy thing to do. They would say that it's a necessary thing to do.
And maybe let's don't go into the details, but you and I both go to a church that has
exactly.
this story.
Exactly.
Right? Where there are multiple congregations of several languages that meet on site, a ministry that serves a whole region of our city, mm-hmm. A really well-regarded seminary, mm-hmm. All of that. And so, you know, it's not just from books. This is something that we see every day.
Yeah. And the one thing that I would add to our story where we go to church is that it's a You know, it's a church that was built back in the 1950s, but it's been, all of what you just described has produced resources. It's made it possible for them to keep the building up to date and making it possible to use it in all those ways that you just described.
And I don't know the whole story, and we don't have to say it mm-hmm. here, but it's very clear to me that they started working on that before they had to.
Right.
Yeah, if that no makes question. Sense.
Yeah,
if no they question. Had waited until now to work on that, it would have been impossible.
Yeah. So one other thing that I want to say about the building, you know, we've said several times in this in this presentation, we're not attempting to provide a comprehensive blueprint for building a healthier culture. What we're attempting to do is to frame the conversation, offer some resources, and just provoke your imagination. One book that I found particularly helpful in provoking my imagination is by Audrey Warren and Kenneth Carter Jr. It's entitled Fresh Expressions of People Over Property. The subtitle is Scripture Stories and Strategies to Help People of Faith Reimagine Their Space. And the whole book, the stories come from around the world, but the whole book is about how people have done the very thing that the title envisions and that we've been talking about. So if you're looking for something that might provoke your own imagination, that might be a resource that you would go to. So that's not everything there is to say about this, your building, but let's stop there and now turn our attention to space in a different way as we think about space being the external neighborhood context.
And so again, I mean, we can't talk about changing culture without thinking about how we associate culture with a neighborhood context. Neighborhood mm-hmm. contexts have personalities, they have histories. Some of them are really rich history, and some of them are rapidly changing. But just think about, so if I say Manhattan, you think of a certain culture. And if I say LA, you think of a different culture. And there's just a shorthand to that, you know? And even if I say Manhattan and then I say Queens, you know, you just get a different sense of culture from naming those places. But the pace of change is one of the things that we have to really look at. So for example, you know, 60 years ago, if I said Hollywood, you would have one idea about culture, right? You would think of movie stars and mansions. Today, Hollywood is nothing like that. And, you know, has struggles with the kinds of challenges that all urban areas do these days when you put a bunch of people in a space together. And sometimes I think we're not very adept at keeping up with the changes that are happening in the spaces mm-hmm. that we occupy. So, you know, the pace of change today means that our neighborhoods are changing over time. I don't know any place where that's not true. And let's be honest, in the wake of COVID, and as you know, businesses go away and other businesses come in, I think it's just going to accelerate what was already happening. And so your neighborhood is going to change over time. And if the church can't keep up with what those changes mean for the gospel, for mission, then, you know, that shows. I know a church here in Houston, Northwest Houston, this would have been a few decades ago, but as their neighborhood started to change, you know, the first thing that happens is that the people who went there, they move away, but they keep driving into church, right? And then they moved away so that they wouldn't have to live and work near the people who were moving into that neighborhood, right? And so now they start thinking, well, we don't really want to have a church in a neighborhood like this, you know, that is no longer where we are no longer the majority and the dominant influence. And so they kind of circle the wagons. And in this particular church, they actually decided in a business meeting not to admit for membership people from the surrounding area. Now, most churches are not going to make it that formal, but this church did. And then they started to decline, and they declined and declined and declined and declined until a friend of ours actually sold the building and closed the doors. Today, in that same building, there are, like you were describing a while ago, multiple congregations and nonprofits, and it is a very dynamic community neighborhood center where things are happening. And it's kind of a tragedy that that congregation could never see those possibilities.
Yeah. And you tell that story, and that happened over several decades. I think there's two things to just like shine a bright spotlight on. One of them is the pace of change. That could happen in a year or two or five.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the other is, if you don't make changes in how you do ministry based on your context, I've heard pastors say on many occasions, my church is providing ministry to a world that doesn't exist anymore.
Exactly.
And the faster the pace of change is, and the more your immediate external context is, the more that's going to be an issue that you have to face. And so it raises the question, then how do you know about your neighborhood? Well, I can remember, you know, back again, when I was working at UBA, church planting was a really important part of what we did. And the primary way that you knew about a neighborhood then was, they called it exegeting a neighborhood. And the primary way that you did that was there are people out there who provide demographic and psychographic services. And so demographics are like the ethnicity, the education, the age, all that kind of stuff. Psychographics tells you more about the purchasing, the things that motivate people's purchasing power. Psychographically, they divide our nation into 16 different groups. And I could name several churches in Houston that, you know, 30 years ago built a church, and they said, of these 16 groups, we are only going to reach this one psychographic entity. And every decision went through that. I would say that both the demographic and the psychographic information is important. I think it's still a helpful tool. But when it's done as the only way of knowing your neighborhood, I think it increasingly is seen as treating your neighbor as an object rather than a subject. I got introduced to that language of object and subject several years ago by a different community that we're a part of. But, you know, when you treat ministry where the people that you're ministering to are objects of your ministry, you have something that you want to deliver to them. And you go deliver that, whether it's something that they want or need or not, it's something you want and need. And so you go deliver that, as opposed to where the people in the community are subjects, they're people, they're friends, they're relationships, they're people who have resources and who have things to teach you as well as you do them. I love the story of Cornelius and Peter. You know, where all my life I got taught that as Peter was the hero, Cornelius was the needy guy. But you read the story and two things are clear. Both of them are men of God. And the other thing that's clear is that God used each of them in the other's life. But for that to happen, you know, he was in his home. They were sharing a meal. There was a relationship there that wouldn't have happened if Peter had psychographically, you know, scanned the neighborhood and said, okay, there's a guy that we don't want to try to reach because he's a Gentile. So then let's talk about some other ways or some additional ways that you can do this work. About 18 or 19 years ago now, Betty and I served as the pastors for about more than a decade of a network of house churches down in the Montrose community, which is a inner city community of Houston. And I want to, one of the things that we did was we prayer walked the community. And so we divided up into teams of three. And we started out with a 5x5 block area, and then we did a 10x10 area, and then we did a 20x20 block area. And we what we did was we just walked through the community, looking for things that were in the community, wondering about what kinds of opportunities there were there, what kind of needs there were there, who were the people that lived there, you know, where were the barking dogs, and where were the people who sat out on the front porch and talked to you when you went by. One of the things that grew out of that, we didn't know this when we first went there, but one of the things that grew out of that was, as we were kind of reporting back on what we discovered, we discovered that there were 8 halfway houses within a 1 mile radius of where our church was meeting. Hmm. You think that's going to have something to do with what kind of ministry you do? And that just happened because we were out prayer walking the community, walking through, asking God to give us wisdom, to help us to meet our neighbors. We weren't walking along praying like you pray in church. We were walking along praying silently. We were engaging people who would talk to us in conversations. So that's one of the ways. One of the ways is by interviewing key leaders, school principals, business owners, nonprofit leaders, your own neighbors. The goal there is several fold. The goal there is to build relationships, first of all. Like, that's the beginning place, is that when I begin to see you as not somebody that I'm trying to change or, quote, reach or get to join my church, but as a human being who, because you exist as a human being, you have the right to be respected and to be honored and to be treated with kindness. And so that's a part of the goal. The other thing that interviewing community leaders does is it helps you to learn the community narrative. Now, if you in this course, we talked about the narrative in a church. Well, a community has a narrative too. There've been significant things that have happened. I remember when I moved into the a suburban community in Fort Worth and was serving a church there, 20 years before we moved there, a tornado had nearly wiped the community out. And there was some sense in which the narrative of the community, were you here or were you not here, was what was kind of a defining characteristic of who belonged and who didn't belong. Alan Roxburgh, who's one of my favorite theologians, you can, Roxburgh, you can look him up, and he's written a number of books. But one of the things that he says is that this kind of work, what we need is detectives who can sleuth out the activity of God. And so if we talk about mission in this contemporary context being identifying the activity of God and joining God in that activity, then not only are we building relationships with key leaders, but we're also beginning to gather information that helps us to see where God's already at work ahead of us. And then I think the third thing, again, these are not the only things, but there are three things that I think are important. The third thing is looking for ways to get up under what is happening in the neighborhood. Again, I think this is just a fundamentally different way in the attractional model and the missional model. In the attractional model, everybody came to church for Vacation Bible School. And then somewhere along the way, we realized they're not coming to church for Vacation Bible School. And so what we did was we said, we're going to do Vacation Bible School in a backyard Bible club. We didn't change anything about what we were doing. We just changed the context that we were in. This way of thinking is to say there's already stuff that's going on out there. And we don't go in as the Christians who know the truth with a community of people who don't know the truth, but more like Peter and Cornelius, as we develop relationships, God uses all of us in each other's lives. And so it gives us a place where we can see what's happening. And rather than starting something new or creating something, what we can do is we can just get up under the activity that's there in the community that leaders who are indigenous to that community are creating, and join them in that kind of process. So those would be three things that that might help you think about how you get connected to your context.
So for many of us, this is just a conversation. This is a conversation we need to be having with each other, with ourselves, with people who study this kind of thing, with our congregation leaders. And I just want to say, it is okay if this conversation makes you nervous. I mean, we humans are very attached to our places and our spaces. We are biologically wired to settle in a place and attach our identity to a place. And I think probably everyone listening to this call has experienced what happens when you try to change things up. I remember early in ministry, one of the angriest I have ever seen anybody about anything that happened at church was when, for reasons I don't even remember, we moved the communion table and the pulpit into the hallway. And, I'm sure to create space, And this man was spitting angry. And he kept talking about, we moved the holy furniture. And I just still remember that phrase, holy furniture. But, you know, that's what happens when we start talking about stuff like this. And, you know, I remember being part of a church that was really trying to say, what kind of space do we need for our community? And ended up moving out of the building that they were in just a little ways down the road, just to have more space and more parking and all that sort of thing. And I cried the day we moved, because I had gotten married in that church, and both my kids were born while we lived in that church, or while we worked at that church. And, you know, and I was fully on board with the idea that we needed different space. And I still cried letting go of that location. And so we will feel anxious, and other people in our congregations will feel anxious about the thought of change. And I just want to say, I think that's okay. Our brains need time to adjust. And so, you know, we can grieve changing space. We can grieve the unfamiliarity maybe of a rapidly changing neighborhood. That's human. And it can be handled, I think, with empathy and not just judgment. Not wanting to see space change doesn't make us bad people. It just speaks to our human condition.
It reminded me that one of the adages from adaptive leadership resources is that people don't resist change so much as they resist loss.
Yeah.
And when we can help them grieve appropriately, then it makes it easier for them to embrace the change that they're after. Well, we could talk a long time about this, but we need to close this conversation. So we want to invite you to, those of you who are listening, to be still in the presence of God and see what you're present to. What has this conversation stirred up for you? In what ways is your imagination being triggered? In what ways do you find yourself resisting or feeling overwhelmed or feeling grief? Both of those responses can be used by the Spirit to help you explore off the map and learn new ways to use your facility and relate to your community as we continue this ongoing conversation about culture and how we increase the positive impact of our cultures in the places that we live and serve.